grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 204 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. We have had some amazing discussions so far this year, everything from the purported niece of D.B. Cooper to here recently talking with our great and good friend, Dr. John Hall, about all of the sonic attacks on the embassies, both in Cuba and in China, the continued denial of that happening, as well as the total disregard for victims' health from the people who were there. Very little has been done for them medically. And with that, we roll right into Raul Diego, the writer and director of Borderline, The Unhinged Truth About the Drug War. Welcome back, Raul. How have you been?
Thank you, Chris. I've been well, doing getting my eye on some new things.
Yeah. And I mean, you were always out doing some amazing reporting. For those of you that don't follow him, make sure to go check out Deep City Chronicles online. That's where, of course, you can check out quite a bit of the work by Raul, as well as Boiling Frogs. Am I correct?
Oh, no. Boiling Frogs is Sibel Edmonds' old platform. I don't know if she's still on that. It's Newsbud.
That's right. That is what has taken its place. So go check out Newsbud by Sibel Edmonds. That's one of the other places where Raul puts his work out. And he's always looking up new and interesting things going on. The one that we have covered more than once here on this show, as the story has kind of developed and the arc of the story has developed, is Borderline, The Unhinged Truth About the Drug War. You finally put out the finished documentary, which rolls right at about an hour and a half in length. Tell us a little bit about how that story wrapped for you. Number one, what was it that for the new audience who has not heard from you yet, Raul, what was it that made you want to take on this story to begin with in the way that you did? And where did you end up with it personally? Like, how did you resolve with the story? I know that's always an interesting point of view from writers and directors, is how things wrapped up for them.
Well, the story, I mean, the first time my attention was drawn to the story was when I received just a link in an email from my mom, actually. She sent me a link to the story about the jail in northern Mexico, of how these, you know, this drug cartel, the Zetas, were controlling this prison and doing all kinds of incredibly, you know, ridiculous stuff in the prison. And I started reading. I downloaded the investigative report that was issued by Colegio de Mexico about that particular prison. And then I started looking into the broader story of why that investigation happened. And then I came across the massacre that happened in northern Coahuila by the Zetas, using the people from the prison. And then it all, you know, at that point, I decided that I was going to make a documentary, a docu-series, really, about this incident. But I didn't really want to put out just a piece on, you know, what happened in the prison and in this place in Mexico without having a broader look, especially in the climate that we have now, you know, with Trump and his rhetoric about the wall and all that stuff. You know, I didn't want to just put that out there because then, you know, everybody would be like, oh, well, you see, we need the wall.
Well, yeah, yeah. This is exactly why we need it, everybody.
Yeah, yeah, because
all the bad hombres and their drugs across the border, you know.
Right, exactly. So, you know, that at that point, I decided that I was going to, you know, do something broader. As far as like, creatively and artistically, I decided to start at the small side of it, you know, the particular, the you know, what's happening on the ground, you know, the incidents in northern Mexico, the incidents in the prison and all, how all that works. And then, you know, kind of expand the view, go back into the origins of, you know, drug trafficking on this side, you know, in this hemisphere, you know, and who is really behind all of those networks that are still functional to this day.
Yeah, and that's that was one of the things that I absolutely loved that you did. Like you said, the first part of the film really starts out in Piedras Negras, right across the border, and goes through the prison there that was utterly controlled. And it's pretty commonplace, you know, that organized crime has a really good foothold, be it in county jails, what have you. You know, it's right. You're pretty hard pressed to be that high up in the criminal food chain and actually live like a criminal whenever you go to jail. But there's a difference between someone like Pablo Escobar, like having dancers come in, you know, to entertain his troops, and what was going on at the prison there with the Zetas, because they had full on factories, like creating their fake uniforms that they used in smuggling. Like they smuggled people into the factories to finish the fabrication on these things.
Right.
Like it was pretty incredible. Like just to sit there and watch and go like, wow, like they were manufacturing hollowed out body parts for cars in this prison.
they were doing everything. It was their, basically their place, you know, the prisoners were incidental essentially to the operation. And really, I didn't even, you know, if you go and read the entire report, if, you know, if any of you out there read Spanish, go to borderlinedocumentary.com, and I have a list of sources and it's all in there, and you can read the 70 plus page report. And I just touched basically on a few of the things that were going on. I didn't even go all in.
Oh, you know? Yeah. And I mean, even the topic of it being used as one of their factories for body disposal from their crimes, things like that. Well, like I said, it's one thing to know that, like, the criminal organization has a foothold in there. Because I mean, that's their training school, you know, that's where you're going to find your best recruits, is young guys that are getting ready to get out. And to know that they were so entrenched that not only were they able to pull off these crimes inside of there, they were able to use the place as a processing facility to dump bodies.
Yeah, to dump and kill them there as well. Yeah. You know, some got there alive, some got there already dead.
Yeah, they had people there that tortured them and all kinds of stuff.
And also one of the more subtle things, you know, about that whole story was, you know, and it ties into the bigger picture of it, is that, you know, the Mexican government, the Mexican federal government, throughout this whole time was still taking care of the prison itself. Like they weren't, the subtlety is that they're in, you know, they are the real bosses, you know, the higher up, you know, the politicians, you know, the generals, these are the people who are actually in charge, you know, the capos and, you know, the El Chapos and all these guys, they're just grunts.
Yeah, they're guys that have come along because the last guy got killed or went to prison.
Right, they're the guys that they put out there to, you know, to take, you know, they're the front line, essentially.
Yeah, they are the fall guy, ultimately. And it is the upper echelon, the higher up people, the, like you were saying, the people like Calderon, presidents who were fully in the pocket of these criminal organizations.
And it's not even in the pocket. That's actually a kind of a misnomer, because that implies that they're actually like getting bribed. But the fact is that they're not getting bribed. Well, they own the business. You know, they're getting the share. You know, all these people are getting the lion's share of the profits, and it goes all over the place. It doesn't stay in Mexico. This is worldwide.
Well, you know, let's get into that just a little bit. How was it that, number one, the Zetas came into power in Mexico, and how does that relate to this entire, like you're saying, worldwide organization? Because it, I mean, so frequently we do think about the drug war just being directly across our southern border. You know, we think about it in that Nicaraguan terms, the way that we did back in the 80s with Manuel Noriega and Panama, things like that. But the fact that it goes into a global network, break that down for our audience a little bit, and how the Zetas actually came into power in Mexico.
Well, the Zetas, as far as, you know, that group in particular, they're kind of, you know, you can think of them kind of as an upstart group. You know, not they weren't the most powerful cartel in Mexico. They were certainly considered the most violent because of, you know, this guy, the leader, Z40. Yeah, he was just psychotic, and he just liked blood and guts. So, you know, the Zetas were – and he was actually curiously, he was the only non-army guy that ever led that cartel. And the Zetas themselves, they were formed by ex-military guys who essentially deserted Mexican military, but were actually trained in the United States by Bill Clinton in Fort Bragg back in when Clinton was president. A lot of these guys came from the school, you know, what they call the School of the Americas, but it was like kind of brought back. It used to be in Central America, and then they brought it, you know, back on the mainland.
Yeah, it was just outside of Mena, Arkansas, and they did some training in Louisiana as well.
Right, and a lot of these guys that became the Zetas were trained in these American facilities, and yes, they have serious, you know, they have direct links with, of course, we'll call them rogue elements of the deep state, U.S. deep state, but of course it's a little more widespread than that. They're not just, you know, guys running around doing things they shouldn't. You know, they're part of a very high up cabal that's been operating for a long, long time, decades. You know, I'm borderline. I kind of keep it. It's not that I keep it light, but I do keep it broad. I don't really go in deep, you know, even though I touch on, you know, the Boston, you know, the Brahmins and the opium and all that stuff. It goes much deeper and much wider, you know. It's like but also what I was getting at is, as far as the Zetas and as far as the drug war has its own particular goals. You know, there's a reason the drug war is being waged, and it has nothing to do with drugs. The actual sale of the drugs, the actual market, and the profits from the drugs have another purpose altogether, which is basically to provide liquidity to the market. It's cheap money that, you know, the market uses to keep, you know, the sham going, essentially.
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, I don't deal with that particular part in the movie, but, you know, that's the so-called war on drugs and the actual profits from the drug trade, which are phenomenal. You know, those are funneled into, you know, all kinds of capital markets throughout the world. And, you know, there's many sources of illicit money, which is basically cheap money, you know, money that you can borrow for 5% instead of 15%.
Sure.
You know,
well, in I think it's about the third part of the movie, you actually start going into it's about halfway through, you start going into the financial breaking of Mexico, the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, as well as the structure of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the structural adjustment programs that countries like Mexico were put through. Now, you yourself were actually from Mexico originally and now live in the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. What were things like? What do you remember things being like when you lived in Mexico? And what is the difference now economically? Because I know when I was a kid and my dad did crazy business down in Del Rio and was always across the border, like, you know, it was pretty close to dollar for peso for quite a while. And then one day it just tanked.
Yeah, I mean, Mexico's economy was pretty robust during the 50s and the 60s. It was actually growing very steadily.
Yeah, one of the best silver providers in the world. Same with gold. Like, we purchased most of our gold from Mexico.
Yep. No, I mean, it was Mexico's heyday in terms of economic growth and progress. A lot of things were getting done. You know, they built the UNAM is you know, the big university in Mexico that is, you know, that it was built back then, and it's a huge, you know, boon for Mexican society because it's free, you know, it's free education.
Yeah.
And essentially, you know, all that started changing in the late 70s when these economic hitmen were hitting up everything. They were going, you know, to all parts of Latin America to destabilize and to basically open the markets of what was a very protectionist region. And through the tactics of these economic hitmen and other factors, you know, they managed to break the economies of several countries, not just Mexico. And I mean, I'm not old enough to have seen. I mean, I lived through. I was, you know, when the peso tanked, I was, I think, I don't know, 10 years old or something. I was in Mexico, and it was a little bit before the earthquake of 85, mm-hmm. which, you know, even exacerbated the problems. But, you know, all hell broke loose. You know, when the peso tanked, I mean, the banks were trying in any way possible to keep the money in Mexico. They were giving people 100% interest on their savings accounts. You know, they were just going crazy trying to keep the money that was just shooting out of Mexico at the fastest speed possible. And it was all part of a strategy that was laid on Mexico by these economic hitmen, which, you know, it developed later on into the importation of the Colombian cocaine to funnel it through Mexico into the United States, using the U.S. Army. That's what Iran-Contra was all about. And but ultimately, you know, the real purpose of the war on drugs is to make South America and Central America, and in the case of Mexico, North America, pliable to the interests of multinational agribusiness, chemical, and big pharma. You know, that's the end goal. And where I leave off, you know, in fact, where I leave off in Borderline is what's happening now. Because now what we have is, you know, they're going into Venezuela, and it's all part of the same, you know, situation. You know, they're going into Venezuela, and the whole point is to keep, you know, is to destroy subsistence farming communities, to destroy any sort of local viable economic model that is not based on multinationals. And that's what they're going in there for.
Yeah. And, you know, when you go into it in Borderline, the Unhinged Truth of the Drug War, it's very interesting the way that you bring in, of course, and I mean, I've just got to bring it up, but the previous opium trade in America, and how that eventually led to slavery, the same routes were used, the same people were in business, and it utterly led to the same exact methods being used to traffic drugs from South America to here, to use shell companies, shell societies, and things to hide money and keep that kind of stuff, I guess, out of the public eye, even to the point where millions of dollars, almost billions, were actively cleaned by banks like HSBC and others to the tune of right into the billions of dollars to the point where they were like, well, we can't put any indictments down because if we do, it'll just crash the financial system.
Right, right. It's the same old excuse. But no, I mean, what was, you know, those institutions, you know, banks, particularly the Atlanticist Axis, you know, the Western, you know, United States, Britain, Australia, and all these guys, you know, they are a cartel. You know, they run the financial system of the world, and they are the ones who are laundering all this money every day, all day. Of course, they're not going to indict anybody there because, you know, that's part of the game. You know, they're the ones bringing out the cheap money so that the system can keep going. That's the whole point of it. They're not going to bring it down.
Yeah. And even my notes here, actually, it was $900 million just by HSBC alone.
And at that particular time, you know, it's like when they were looking.
yeah, that was just the 1 year,
right?
Where it was like, oh, hey, yeah, look at what we happened to find. You know, you left this sitting around.
That was just 1 year, and that was just in Mexico.
Yeah. So I mean, it's mind-boggling to sit back and think about this, and to think about the purposeful web that is woven in order to keep something like this afloat and to keep it going.
One of the things I hope to portray, to show in the movie was the difference between, you know, those people on the ground, you know, the grunts doing the day to day stuff versus the people who are actually maneuvering the whole enchilada, so to speak.
Yeah, the puppet masters behind things. And even to go into things like you were talking about earlier, people like Barry Seal, people like Gary Webb, who were whistleblowers, who came out against this stuff eventually. Barry Seal was, of course, assassinated outside of his outside of where the hotel where he was under house arrest.
Yeah, in Baton Rouge.
And his plane was later used to smuggle Ollie North. And it was one of those, hey, how did he get access to that? Well, that was the plane that was used to smuggle everything in Iran-Contra. That's how. And just the wild connections that go on. I mean, all the way to G.W. Bush, and his connection with Barry Seal, as well as his connection, of course, with the CIA, and where things started going in 79 when Edmund Pratt was brought into the ACTN.
Yeah, that's the real key to understand, you know, because, you know, we all get caught up in the spy game and the CIA and the wet work and all that stuff. Yeah. But, you know, behind all this are these multinational corporations who are the driving force behind these policies and these, you know, acts. You know, on the one hand, you have these little guys on the street, you know, and you have even the DEA and the FBI playing their little games, you know, cops and robbers. Meanwhile, you know, this huge subversion of sovereignty is going on throughout the world.
Yeah.
You know, using this, you know, the so-called war on drugs to basically, you know, eradicate all kinds of local communities and bring in, you know, multinational agribusiness, you know, selling seeds, patented seeds, basically destroying people's land to use it themselves, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's probably one of the most key pieces of the puzzle that you throw in, is the Intellectual Property Act that went through back in 82, talking about the GATT talks with IBM and Monsanto and other companies being involved with the writing of international regulation that went into IPs, which is intellectual property, folks. That's basically like patents, things like that. These laws attached to laws and
all
presidential directives. Go ahead.
All in an exact parallel to the unfolding of the war on drugs. Like they were run at exactly the same time,
hand in
by
hand,
essentially the same people.
Yeah, and to see the fact that intellectual property, through this in 1982, it becomes a matter of national security. Is that correct, or is it 79?
No, it was within 1 year they were both declared. IP was declared a national security, and then narcotics, yeah, like a year later.
Yeah, because it was Presidential Directive 221 that made drugs fall under the guise of national security.
Right.
And to know that that is what set up for things like Southcom. That's what set up for us to be able to basically train insurgent forces on our soil to put into place and take over these cartels.
Right. And all these, you know, drug war bilaterals, you know, they're reaping the benefits. You know, right now, you know, Colombia and Brazil, you know, Colombia had the Plan Colombia that Clinton brought in.
Yep.
And the Andean Initiative by Bush before him, you know, all these things, you know, set up what's happening now with Venezuela. You know, now they have troops at the border with Venezuela, and these are all drug war trained troops, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all for this, you know. They're going into Venezuela and they're going to destroy that part of the world. And, you know, when I talk in part three, the last part of part three, about Southcom and that paper that they published back in 2007,
yep,
and how they're going, you know, how they were, you know, they were tasked to, you know, find countries to accept refugees and immigrants, you know, all this is planned. You know, when they go into Venezuela now, people don't realize how that's going to displace millions of people.
Yeah.
And everybody's going to go everywhere and they're going to come here. You know,
no, I wish more people realized that what is going on right now with the caravans is a litmus test. It's
right.
It's not just a litmus test as to what the southern border of America will put up with. It's a litmus test as to what all the countries in between the two.
Right. And Southcom's role in picking and choosing who's going to take in who. And all that stuff, you know?
And it's very maniacal once you start putting these pieces of the puzzle together, once you start seeing this, especially once you start seeing the 1989 Defense Authorization Act that made military intervention part of standard drug policy inside the U.S. and outside. It made the military the head of drug intervention.
Drug interdiction, basically.
Interdiction, yes.
They were the ones who were, you know, looking out for where the drugs were, which basically, you know, gives them carte blanche to do all the smuggling.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Which had been the case for a long time to begin with, since,
right.
I mean, at least, you know, Operation Phoenix, things like that in Vietnam, Air America, all that kind of thing.
And before that, the story of the heroin addiction of Harlem, and you know how that came to be. All that is, you know, CIA black ops.
Yeah.
And this is 1940s we're talking about, you know.
Yeah, it's and there have been a couple of movies written about that kind of stuff. And it's really interesting to see it, but yours is the only movie that I have seen that really lays out this web of laws that were passed purposefully. I mean, there's no other reason for them. Economy was getting along just fine without them. The world was getting along just fine without them. And suddenly, once these things are put into place, you start seeing the drug war happen. You start seeing military bases rise up in small countries that are, you know, making generic medications, things like that. It's really wild, even to take it into the current trade war right now, which is about 70% predicated on the case of intellectual property. It's frightening. It's frightening.
Yeah, I mean, this is the actual war that they're fighting. You know, they frame it in these terms of terrorism and drugs and evildoers and all that stuff. But, you know, there's a whole hidden agenda behind this that only the people, you know, in the highest places know. And of course, they're never going to get anybody to go to war over that. So they have to frame it in these, you know, these terms where people want to come in over the walls and kill you, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting that you bring up terrorism, because I remember after 9/11, there was like the whole string of new drug commercials that were kind of like the "this is right. a brain on drug" style. But it was like, hey, yeah, hope you're enjoying that joint you're smoking. You just provided this much ammunition for terrorists. Yeah. It's like, whoa, really? And like they start laying the math down, you know, of like that joint was bought off this much marijuana, which came off this much, which came over the border, that came from Afghanistan. And it's like, what? What are you like? It was some of the most spurious reasoning in the world, but completely and utterly what you're talking about as far as straight propaganda.
Meanwhile, you know, the very first thing that the U.S. Army does in Afghanistan is restore the poppy seed cultivation.
Yes,
you know, which is the only reason they went
and protect it,
right?
Set up guard around it, you know, and. I found that interesting as well, that that was a crop that the cartel in Mexico eventually turned to, was poppy and growing poppy there in Mexico as well.
Well, they've been doing that for a very long time. I mean, those are the poppy cultivation in Sinaloa has been basically a staple for a long time. I mean, it was imported completely legally into the United States for years. You know, that's how they got, you know, for the morphine a lot during Vietnam. It was coming a lot from Mexico.
Okay.
So, you know, it depends where you're looking from, you know, basically.
Yeah. And one of the interesting cases that you brought up, that I love that you brought up toward the end, was of course the case of El Chapo. And the arrest of El Chapo, and his brother specifically, Jose Trevino. I'm sorry, he was the brother of Z40,
right,
in the Zetas, but had been a completely law abiding citizen until getting involved with his brother and quarter horse breeding, things like that.
Well, yeah, that was the whole. You know, what happened in what I get into in the first part, you know, with the massacre and the whole thing with the prison, you know, it's all brought on by this, you know, multi-agency investigation on the horses and the horse breeding and the horse races. And it eventually just produces, you know, they give this guy 20 years for basically, you know, racing horses. Using the seed money from his brother and all that stuff. But, you know, all that, you know, during that investigation is when they discover the actual, you know, the big boys, you know, HSBC and Citibank, And then, you know, Fast and Furious, which is actually, you know, the guns that actually killed the agent that set off the whole investigation were from here.
They were from the beginnings of the Fast and Furious investigation, where they were trying to actively entrap and ensnare members of the cartel.
Well, no, that wasn't their excuse. What they were saying was that they were sending the guns to Mexico to keep track of them, you know, not necessarily capture them, but just know where they are at all times. Yeah. But Fast and Furious was just one of many. There were several gun running operations going on simultaneously. And the ironic part is that, you know, the whole investigation is launched because this ICE agent is killed in Mexico. And that's why they start going after Z40 in the first place. And and then they find out that it's their own government who's supplying the guns, you know, their own banks who are laundering their money.
Yeah.
But none of those people get touched. You know, they go after this poor sap, you know, Jose, who, you know, in comparison has done nothing.
Yeah.
And then the snitch, the guy who's been informing for the FBI, gets to keep, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of, you know, basically illegal gains.
Yeah.
It's all very, you know, it's all very, how should I put it?
Typical.
Well, typical and, you know, kind of, you know.
What's crazy is that you would struggle to write a Hollywood script.
Right.
With this kind of intrigue.
I can't.
I mean, like, people sit around in rooms for months, like groups of 10 to 20 people trying to write this kind of convoluted story.
It would be rejected. Too many ins and outs.
Yeah, there's too many things to tie together by the end of a season, guys. Like, we gotta simplify this. But yet still, like, you do such a great job. And what I find interesting about Borderline, the Unhinged Truth About the Drug War, is that there are tidbits and things in there. If you go out and dig, folks, and find the actual parts of the movie of the movie itself, there are some little parts and things like that here and there that actually dig a little bit deeper than the whole documentary itself. Like the whole section about the founding of America and the founding of America as a bunch of drug runners, things like that. That section goes entirely deeper.
Absolutely. Segment. That's kind of the idea. You know, you have all sorts of leads throughout. You know, the only thing where I go into details is you know, the stories on the ground, you know, the very particulars of the incidents in Mexico.
Exactly. And that's what I liked, was that in the finished product, you actually went more into depth than those, like the wrap up with the Trevino, things like that. The way that some of that was revealed, that never really made it to mainstream media.
In
the way that Fast and Furious was covered, if it was covered at all.
There were never any they never tied any loose ends together. They never presented a cohesive, coherent picture of what is actually going on. You know?
And there were rumors of much larger arms sales than just, like, you know, 50 calibers and fully automatic and, you know, some light mortars, things like that.
They were giving them, you know, surface-to-air missiles and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty comprehensive, the list of things. And like you lay out in the movie, those don't just pop up on the open market.
Right.
You know, those don't even necessarily just pop up on the black market. Like, you got to have some kind of access to get those.
Well, I mean, Fast and Furious itself is an example of that. It's all sanctioned. You know, this is all, you know, they can put up all the excuses they want, but these are operations that are initiated and run by people who are officially in charge. You know, they're not, going behind any doors. They're doing it from the offices in the DOJ, and you know, it's happening for real. You know, it's not some guy, you know, smuggling weapons out of a laundry bag out of the, you know, the army surplus and going to Texas or something.
Yeah, it's not somebody's underground bunker in their backyard, full of buckets of ammunition. When you're talking about people like Robert Tosh Plumlee coming out and saying that this was the case, that these weapons were being smuggled over there. He was famous for, of course, him coming out during the Iran-Contra affair, all that to know that people like Phil Jordan, former DEA director, was saying that weapons were taken from DFW to the border.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much that I can just point to. You know, it's like look at this, and then look at that, and look at this. You know, it's up to the people who see it. You know, they can pick and choose whatever rabbit hole they want to go down because it's just full of them. You know, the entire film is just, you know, pointing to things. I'm not even going into detail in anything. It's just painting a picture, putting it together, making sure people understand how they work together and how everything is, you know, is not as they present it to you.
Yeah, it's not as cut and dry as what you hear on the 10 o'clock news.
Right.
It really isn't. And I've said that for years. I've said that for years on this show. Our hands are so entirely filthy.
It's amazing. It's amazing. You know, it's really, you got to tip your hat off to the level of propaganda that they've managed to achieve. You know, people, you know, just buying this complete fairy tale of what this country actually is.
Yeah. And I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, we're still incredibly blessed. We have freedoms unlike many other countries in the world. But my God, we do some horrific things while the populace is asleep at night, folks. We attach horrible things to bills and laws that let things like this go through. Horrible presidential directives that place things like drugs under the guise of national security so that these things can take place under a black budget. And it's just everyday business.
That's all it is.
It is the business of America.
And some people know it and basically are on board with it. You know, they're like, "Oh yeah, this is our team." You know, that's what we do. But most of the people are just oblivious.
Well, and it really is that horribly twisted swordfish mentality of I'm going to do these horrible things in the name of God and country to protect God and country. And I have to do these horrible things. Otherwise, like, more horrible things will happen.
Right.
And I mean, it's kind of frightening to know that that is literally the mentality. You know, I believe it was Noam Chomsky that said, the illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little while longer. And it's true, because once you do the illegal and you get away with it and people go, "Oh, well, that was horrible." You know what we should have is a law that prevents that. You know what? You're right. We should totally have legislation that stops that. And then suddenly people are begging for the control.
Right.
And it's nothing to stir it up. It's nothing to make it happen. And to look at programs like this, to look at situations like what we have actively done to South America, what you lay out in the movie where, you know, what are we going to say about the Amazon basin? You know, countries like Chile, who have some of the largest lithium reserves in the world, you know, things like that. But how do you assure the fact that protections are in place and that these economic plunderers don't come in, get them under their thumb, and basically make them sell their resources out from underneath themselves? Then when they try to gain right to use them, they're like, nope, sorry, we own them. You can't touch a thing about them.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of dirty tricks. You know, what's going on right now in Venezuela, what they've done to that country. You know, for the past 2 years, 3 years, you know, they have unleashed all manner of economic warfare on that country, brought it to its knees. And now, you know, they unveil this CIA bred person, you know, and who self swears himself into the presidency out of nowhere. Meanwhile, you know, the Bank of England has withheld over $1 billion in Venezuela's gold. They've imposed sanctions on the country. They've purposely manipulated the price of oil to tank so that, you know, Venezuela, which basically is completely oil dependent, will, you know, its economy will completely crash, and which of course it did. And of course they're saying, oh, well, it's the socialist policies of Mr. Maduro, and he's a dictator and this and that, you know. And now they're ready to go in for the kill. You know, now they're going to go in. They're going to send the troops with all, you know, the Western media backing them and everybody saying, oh, they're heroes for saving the Venezuelan people. Meanwhile, they're going in there. And John Bolton has already said, well, we're going to take the oil, guys. You know, that's why we're there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no pretense anymore. It's all just one big, you know, farce.
Yeah. And a free for all,
yeah.
Quite literally, it is an economic free for all for those pulling the strings.
And you know they have no problem talking about the oil because it's so obvious. But the reality is, you know, the real prize is the Amazon. You know, yeah. That's what they really want because that encompasses all the multinationals. Yeah. You know, they can go in there and just clean up.
Yeah, exactly. With all of the botanicals, things like that, that can be used for pharmaceuticals. It's a vastly untapped resource. Like you said in the movie, it would be impossible for them not to want to go after it. The signs already are the fact that they're trying to go after that kind of stuff, that they are actively these multinational groups who are vested in this game are actively trying to obtain patents for things out of these regions.
Yeah, and it all comes back to the trade deals and all that stuff that Trump scrapped again. And they're going to try to redo them. We'll see what happens. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to actually succeed in their endeavors at this point because it's just so brazen and everybody's just, you know, I went to cover a rally, a supposed pro opposition rally of Venezuelan expats down here. And you can just tell that, you know, even the people there, they're like, you know, they don't really know if they should even be in favor of this, because it's just, you know, it's just so incredible. I mean, Venezuela is a country that is completely oil dependent, and to actually back a coup of your own country and saying, well, we're going to give you all of our oil.
Yeah.
That's treasonous, you know, completely, you know. That's just betraying your country altogether. And you can tell in their faces that they're, you know, in the back of their minds, they realize that. Yeah. So they're not going to completely go into it, I think.
Yeah. And just to see what happens to these countries and the slow and steady, sometimes slow and steady progress of degradation. And granted, Venezuela has been a decade.
Two decades.
Yeah. I guess it was a decade or so since they declared being socialist. But Yeah. And that's one of the lines that's touted all the time, you know, is, oh, yeah, look at what happens, everybody. Yeah, it's also what happens when other governments are propping up puppet regimes.
Well, the government is socialist, but the economy is not socialist. 90% of the businesses in Venezuela are private. Yeah. 90% of the media is private and anti-Maduro. It's all bullshit. And in fact, you know, the so-called, you know, the story about the starving people and not being able to get food. The reason they're not getting food in certain stores is because the owners of those stores are the oligarchs who want Maduro out. And they're the ones who are taking food off the shelves on purpose.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just it's strange the play for power that goes on that is behind all of this. And you break it down so, so well in Borderline, the Unhinged Truth about the Drug War, especially once you start going into Michael F. Walter's 2012 writings and the recent things that are going on in Mexico, where in the first half of 2018 alone, there were right at 16,000 killings.
Yep. The numbers just came out. The numbers just came out for the whole year, and it's like 35.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, and nobody bats an eyelid, you know, and it's really scary. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
My parents live in Acapulco, which is like
– That's in the order of like 100 people a day.
Yep.
That is – wow.
And it pretty much breaks up that way too. Like if you go to Acapulco, is one of the worst places.
Yeah.
You know, every day they'll kill 5-10 people easy.
Oh, man. Wow. And even the mayor of the town, Piedras Negras, was killed. He was – I mean he had – he was – running for office again when it happened, correct? It was just before took place.
He was running for federal office for Congress.
Yeah. And he was out like posing for somebody with a selfie and somebody shot him on the street.
It happened again like 2 weeks ago. Another guy just recently elected that same day.
Yeah.
Assassinated.
So it's frightening the things that we are actively involved in as a country that people are completely blind to. They have no idea that this is what their tax dollars are going toward. That while the rhetoric and the continued rhetoric, folks, of the wall, it's not a new rhetoric. It's not anything that has just popped up on the radar. Like, good God, this originally came through with NAFTA. Like back in the 90s, they were talking about building a wall. I remember when we found out in Texas that there was going to be an unchecked highway from Mexico City to Canada. And it was right. Like, well, no. and I want to say like 72 hours before the vote went down for everything with NAFTA, we had things redrafted to have that removed. Like these are some of the crazy things that they put into laws to specifically put this rhetoric out there and to put the distraction out in front of us. The horrible situation going on our border is nothing new. It's just exacerbated.
Well, it is new in that it didn't exist 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the result of policies and things that are going on not only in Mexico but throughout the region. You know, yeah. Central America has been destabilized for decades now, and all those people, you know, they go into Mexico and they try to come here, and you know, they've been trying to do that for. I mean, Miami's full of Nicaraguans and Guatemalans and people who are displaced by, you know, these civil wars that are bred by the drug war.
Yeah. And that's the horrible thing is that they are people seeking asylum. They are people looking for help.
They're regular people, but the thing is that, you know, Americans have a certain standard of living that is completely unheard of for them. You know, they have no idea how these people live in Nicaragua and in Guatemala. You know, they have no, I see a lot of people on like Twitter and say, well, how can they bring their children with them? And it's like, they think they're taking them out for, you know, for pizza or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's just it. Like you have no idea the fact that, they were probably living in a facility with three walls. You know, there are not many cities as we would call them, per se in a lot of these countries.
No, they're living in a shack, you know, somewhere in the mountaintop with every time it rains, you know, your house disappears.
For them, it's not necessarily brutal hardship. They're already living brutal hardship on the day.
Right. Exactly.
tell everybody where they can go to find the work of Deep City Chronicles, where they can go to find Borderline, the Unhinged Truth About the Drug War, Raul.
Well, the movie is streaming free on borderlinedocumentary.com. You can just go there and you'll find your way to it. And as far as my journalistic endeavors, apart from that, you can go to deepcitychronicles.com. I'll be publishing a piece on the what I call the useful traitors, how the Venezuelan expat community is being used to betray their country.
Ooh.
And so that should be out soon.
Nice. Yeah. And you can also find the work of Raul Diego on Newsbud as well. So make sure to check out all that stuff. Make sure to keep up with the great work that he does with Deep City Chronicles. Thank you so much for taking the time, as always, to come on to chat with us, to lay this stuff out, Raul. It's the journey that you have been on as a writer and filmmaker for this documentary. I cannot even imagine. I know what it was for me. Probably about part three of the documentary when you released it, and I started seeing all the facts about intellectual property. That's when things just took on a fractal aspect for me, and I was like, "Oh, those maniacal." Oh, dude, I don't even want to say the word. My God, what a nefarious scheme. That's horrifying, the fact that they made intellectual property part of national security. Like the things that lays down that are so far reaching and tendril like into not only business but military are
amazing. Everything.
And I can't imagine what it would be like to have actually put those puzzle pieces together. And to have found all of that. And it's all out there, folks. Take interest in your government. When you see these things being passed, like the annual National Defense Authorization Act, that's where the funding for these programs comes from. You know, be involved. Read this stuff. Check it out. I have gone through actually and added some of the things that we talked about in this episode tonight onto the Dudes and Beer Knowledge Vault, because I think that they're so important that more people need to have them at their fingertips. And the fact that you put them all there on your website and everything else as well, Raul, is fantastic, because people definitely need to be aware of what is happening while they are asleep at night.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Anytime. I greatly look forward to your next appearance, Raul. It is always a pleasure talking with you. While you were online checking out the great work of Raul Diego and Deep City Chronicles and awesome full movie Borderline, The Unhinged Truth About the Drug War at borderlinedocumentary.com/full-movie. Make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. That's where you can find all of the great episodes with guests like Raul, people like Dr. John Hall talking about the dangers of 5G, you know, people like Richard Spazoff talking about visions of hell and what it's like to be a medium. All kinds of great content there. Check it out. You can also go to the Dudes and Beer bookstore and find books like Confessions of an Economic Hitman, like what we were talking about tonight, as well as books from our guests. Until next time, everybody, remember, if you can't be good at it, and take care of yourselves and each other. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.